Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. This is Mike Consul, your host. Thank you for joining us. In the spotlight is Susan Shapiro, author of the book Bible, which promises to help readers sell your manuscript no matter what genre without going broke or insane. She is also an award-winning writer and professor, authoring 17 best-selling books such as The Five Men Who Broke My Heart and her recent memoir, The Forgiveness Tour. She lives with her screenwriter husband in Manhattan and uses her writing and publishing guides, the Book Bible and the Byline Bible, to teach her popular Instant Gratification Takes Too Long courses at the New School at NYU and at Columbia University. She obviously has a sense of humor. We join my interview with Susan Shapiro at Full Throttle. Talk about the Book Bible. Let's go through a few of the things that, I mean, based on the subtitle, it sounds like most people who write novels are looking to be genre writers. Is that the truth? Is that the case? And if so, why do people gravitate to genre? Is it because it's the best way to sell the most books?
Well, what I find is that, and in my own experience, I wanted to be a poet with a capital P, and I was a failed poet for a while, and then I decided I wanted to write the great American novel. And you can go to a bookstore and buy a book on how to be a poet or how to publish poetry or how to be a great American novelist. And at a certain point, I was interested in memoirs, and there's books on that. But what I found over a vast career is that there are all kinds of other genres that are actually way, way more open for new writers. And so at this stage, I'm the author, co-author of 17 books my family hates in 8 different genres. And it took me a long time to figure out, what's the easiest, best way to break into books and which categories are more likely to say yes. So what I realized was that none of the books, when you go out to, get any kind of book that's going to help you get published, none of them really go through the whole spectrum. So what I decided, because of course you're supposed to teach the class you wanted to take and write the book you wanted to read, so I decided to put many years of experience and rejection and confusion and finally, therapy and overcoming it and getting the book deal, so put everything I've learned into one book. So I actually have in the Book Bible, How to Sell Your Manuscript No Matter What Genre Without Going Broke or Insane, I actually break it down to 20 different genres and what you need to break into each one, which, like I said, nobody really does the overview. So I have memoir, biographies, how-to, self-help, poetry, anthologies, humor, graphic books, adult fiction, genre fiction, including mysteries and thrillers and romance, all kinds of children's books, picture books, middle grade, young adult, and I also get into how to sell a nonfiction proposal and how to query a literary agent. So it's sort of an overview that most people don't know.
What genre is the richest right now or the most open to new authors?
Well, I personally have found, of course, it depends on everything. It depends on your project. It depends on your talent. It depends on your interest. It depends on everything. But I have found that children's books, just based on students who have, because I've been teaching for so many years, so if I had to add up, I have students that have done, I think it's 165 books in the last 10 years, and people are selling books all the time. Many students have new books coming out. The advance is between $1,000 and $500,000. If I had to add it up, I have more students that have had luck in the kidlit genre, which includes young adult, middle grade, picture books, and with young adult and middle grade, there's nonfiction and there's fiction. And there's a lot of reasons why that might be happening. Number one, I think during the pandemic, there were so many parents buying their kids' books. So maybe it's been hot for a while. It's been hot for about 15 years. But I think that during the pandemic, maybe parents were buying more kids' books because they were homeschooling kids or kids couldn't go to school. I also think perhaps my students are younger. I teach a lot of undergrad, graduate students. So I think somebody who's, for example, 22 years old might not necessarily be able to write the great American adult novel or write a memoir yet or write a biography, yet they're probably closer to the experiences of a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old, which fits YA. So I think there's a certain audience that actually will have better luck trying kids' books. And a lot of people don't know about kids' books. I actually didn't know much about kids' books until I had a co-author. We had a great idea for a book called World in Between, which was about a 12-year-old Bosnian Muslim refugee who was saved by the Council of Synagogues and Churches in Connecticut when he came over this country. And so I had to learn a lot about kids' books, and I went to a lot of my students who were having luck and started understanding the divisions. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Another thing to keep in mind if you're just starting out is I personally feel that nonfiction is much, much easier to sell than fiction. So even though everybody, and poetry, so even though everybody has a fantasy, because it seems as if adult fiction, adult novels, literary novels, and poetry are the most prestigious, they're actually the hardest to write well and sell. And the trick with nonfiction, which I've come to understand having published a lot of nonfiction books now with Penguin Random House and St. Martin's and other good publishers, is that with nonfiction, if you have a great story, that might be enough to get you a book deal. And even if you don't write well or you're not, your writing isn't that sophisticated, if a publisher loves the story that you're bringing in, there's a lot, they have a lot of options, which is they could hire a ghost writer, they could hire a ghost editor, they could help you and hold your hand. If you're doing a self-help book, it could be based on interviews that you're doing with a lot of experts, if you have connections in that area. If you're doing a biography, if you have information about somebody famous that nobody else has, sometimes somebody in your family or somebody that you've known through a friend, that enough could get you a book deal and they'll just help you write it. On the other hand, when it comes to poetry and short stories and novels, it's all about the writing. So it doesn't matter how great the story is, if the writing isn't beautiful and literary and important, nobody's going to look at it. So I think that's why it's a little bit, I've found it's much easier to sell nonfiction. And also the expectation for the writing is not as high, for example, with a self-help book. You know what I mean? Somebody's not buying a self-help book to read lyrical, beautiful prose. They're buying a self-help book because you have an expertise in a certain area and you're promising to give them advice.
Yeah, and they want a 10-point plan for how to solve their problems or a 5-point plan or the Eightfold Path or whatever.
Right, and the truth is a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, for example, I'm a writing teacher, so the book Bible and the Byline Bible are going to be very helpful to people who want to get published because I've spent so many years with that expertise. So if you happen to have an expertise, it's a million times easier to write a self-help book based on an expertise, based on you being able to help people, than it is to craft a novel or short stories or, you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So nonfiction, I think, is actually easier to publish, and a lot of people, I didn't know that. It took me a long time to figure that out.
Well, then you don't write the book. You don't write the book, you write a proposal. So instead of going through all this effort, it does depend.
It depends.
Okay, go ahead.
It depends. You know, so what happens is, I have a Sell Your Book class, a 5-week online Sell Your Book class, and I have 15 speakers, top editors and agents. 15 people will give you 15 different opinions. So in general, if you want to sell poetry, fiction, or a novel, whether it's YA, MG, or an adult novel, or short stories, you have to write the whole thing. That's basically a rule. And with some nonfiction, you can sell some nonfiction on a proposal. That's true. And I include in the book Bible all the different elements that you need in a book proposal to sell your book to a mainstream press to get an advance. That's true. On the other hand, there's a lot of question, for example, if you want to write a memoir but you've never written a book before, instead of doing a proposal, a lot of editors who've zoomed into my classes and a lot of agents say, you know what, we need to see the whole book because a memoir in certain ways is a lot like a novel, so are essay collections. And what happens is a lot of times, say you write 20 beautiful pages or you get a short piece published and they want to sign you up, unfortunately they sign you up, but if you've never completed a 300-page manuscript before, a lot of people choke. So a lot of agents and editors kind of feel like, you know, it's too much of a risk to take a new writer who's never written a book before based on 20 pages, which maybe they've worked on for several years, it's too much of a risk to give them a book deal and assume they're going to be able to finish a project. So they require at least a first draft of a manuscript before they'll give you a book deal. But again, it depends on everything.
What do you prefer?
Which do I prefer?
Nonfiction or fiction? I mean, for yourself.
You know, I'll tell you something. At the beginning, and I sort of write about this in Book Bible, and maybe in Byline Bible too, you know, early on I was a poet with a capital P, and that was my passion and love. And it took, you know, being a failed poet in some ways. I mean, I have a degree and I published it. I published some and I published a book. But a mentor of mine at some point said to me, you have too many words and not enough music. And I was heartbroken, but this particular mentor, who was a poet by night, was a New York Times editor by day, and he started taking my prose. And he said, there's more poetry in your prose than in your poems. So that was an interesting thing that I had to, you know, it took me a lot of years to figure that out. So the subjects that I used to write poetry, I then expanded to essays, and then those essays expanded to memoirs, and that's been thrilling and exciting, and I really love first-person writing. On the other hand, I couldn't sell a couple stories that were too personal as nonfiction, so I've had luck. I've done four novels, and that's been thrilling. And then I actually, it might even be the easiest thing to write in the world is self-help books on topics I'm an expert. So, for example, with the Byline Bible and the Book Bible, these are classes I've been teaching for 25 years, so in a certain way it kind of wrote itself. Once I came up with the concept, it's, you know, it was so much fun to just sort of, you know, share what I share with my students and what I've already learned and tell stories and interview editors and agents I know. So that was fun too. And I actually think it's a really good thing to think about, and I talk about that a lot in the Book Bible, which is really think about what your goal is. And also I have a whole chapter which I call genre fluidity, instead of gender fluidity. And the reason why I write about it is most people don't understand really how many different categories there are, how many different ways you could go and still wind up being a successful writer. So a lot of my students, for example, they'll try writing the great American novel, you know, my MFA students, and they can't get an agent or they can't sell it and they're totally depressed and they want to give up. And I'm like, wait a second here. You know, first off, you don't know what rejection is. You know, I mean, I had 30 rejections from agents and 30 rejections from editors for my first Random House book that turned into a huge bestseller and wound up getting TV and film rights and foreign rights, you know. So somebody gets three rejections, that doesn't mean anything. But also, they haven't really analyzed what they want and what they're bringing to the table. So, for example, I've had several students who have written books that center on a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old. They try to sell it as an adult novel. They don't have luck and they give up. Well, my attitude is, if your protagonist is 12, is it a middle grade book? Go read 100 middle grade books. Maybe you could tell the story instead of an adult looking back, tell it in present tense through the eyes of a 12-year-old, and that's a much more open category. Or a 16-year-old or 17-year-old, that could be potentially a, you know, that could be a young adult book. That's one option. Also, you're calling this a memoir, but it's a little disjointed, and really all you've sold is three essays. Maybe it's an essay collection about ideas instead of a coherent memoir, especially if you're 24 years old and you don't have that much of a history. Maybe it's an essay collection instead. You know, and
now
again,
why do you subtitle, in the subtitle of the Book Bible, you say, without going broke or insane?
Well, I think there's a lot of people out there that'll say, okay, you give me $20,000 and then I'm going to help you write your book. You know, or it's going to, you know, somebody, again, has the fantasy that they're going to be a poet or a novelist, and there's a whole history of poets and novelists who killed themselves partly because it's so complicated and difficult and sometimes impossible to make a living. I remember there was a book I read a long time ago that I liked that I reviewed. It was called Staying Sane in the Arts. And I think sometimes artistic people have extreme personalities, and luckily, because I stuck it out and I had a great therapist, and my husband's a writer also, we've been through a lot, so and we were very determined and very open to hear mentors and older, wiser people who've done it. So what we took into account was that it's extremely, extremely, extremely hard to make a living just based on your art. Maybe impossible. For us, it was pretty much impossible to have a consistent salary. So it's always great to, and I teach my students, it's always great to find another way to make a living, even if it's 10 hours a week of dog walking or babysitting. In our case, it's teaching by night. So find a way to make a living, because then it takes all the pressure off of your creative work, so it has a little bit more time to gel and you don't have to sell out and write crap just to make money. If you have a job that's paying your bills, whether by day or by night, gives you a little bit more leeway. So,
So you need some breathing room there. Take some of the pressure off. You also said, I've written 17 books my family hates. Yeah. Elaborate on that.
Well, okay, so I'm from a conservative Jewish family in Michigan, which has its redneck parts, and it's very conservative, and I'm a raging feminist liberal left winger, and I write very confessionally. I'm very out there. I've been in therapy a long time, and I'm proud of it. And I, you know, everyone where I come from is kind of private, so we've definitely had a lot of discussions about, how open and honest I want to be, and am I allowed to write about people that I know? And you know, I like racy subjects. I mean, Sex Sells, 5 Men Who Broke My Heart was my debut, and then my second book was Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex. So there were definitely issues with my family. Although what I love to point out, and the reason I always say in my bio that it's I'm the author co-author of 17 books my family hates, is that I did a lot of great therapy to understand the situation, which is they're not my audience, and I have a right to tell my story. But my rule with first-person writing especially is I always have to question, trash, challenge, and out myself more than anybody else.
Do you think confessional writing, your confessional writing, is part of the key to your success?
Of course, because it's provocative. You know, I mean, you know, the biggest mistake people make, as I write about, is they, you know, I say, if I say to my students, write a personal essay, I get like boring pieces about how cute my cats are and, you know, what I did on my summer vacation and, you know, my grandpa died and, you know, I just get very typical stuff. So my first assignment that I give them is write about your most humiliating secret that you could put your name on. Now those pieces sing and they get published and they lead to books. In a couple of cases, they've led to movies and staff writer jobs. So yeah, there's an element of being provocative and saying things that other people don't say. In fact, there's a line I really liked by Arthur Miller, which is, he says, the only thing worth writing is the unsaid and the unsayable. And I think William Faulkner said the only subject worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. So there's all kinds of ways to, you know, be provocative and write about drama, conflict, and tension in a way that's exciting. If you write the typical things that everybody else writes, not so interesting.
So provocative, but also honest and authentic, right? People want people who bear their soul, who are being honest with them and authentic with them, correct?
Of course.
So it extends a little beyond just the provocative. It can be, because maybe it's not necessarily wildly provocative, but it is. Wow, this
well, but again, you know, I'm helping people who've never, well, but I'm helping people who've never published before get published. So when we go around and we talk about ideas, so if somebody wants to write a book about how I quit drinking for 3 weeks, even if it's very authentic and honest, it's boring and there's 50,000 books in the bookstore already on that topic. So I'm probably not going to say go for it, or I'm probably going to, ask them to revise it. And I have had a few students who wrote about, just for an example, how hard it is to try to date without drinking and the kind of ridiculous comments you get. Now that's interesting and provocative, right? So I'm just saying that, you know, just even from the inception of an idea to write a short essay or to write an opinion piece, you want to be idiosyncratic and unusual and provocative. You could be really honest, but you could honestly love your cat, and I don't really want to read that piece. On the other hand, I did read a piece about a guy writing about how his longest relationship was with his cat, his longest lasting relationship. That's interesting. See what I mean? Provocative.
Yeah.
You know, like take it a little bit further, be a little bit more dazzling and dramatic when you're pitching an idea.
Now, what's the difference between the Book Bible and the Byline Bible? Is the Byline Bible about freelance writing?
Yeah, so what happens is the Byline Bible is it's subtitled Get Published in 5 Weeks. So the Byline Bible was based on all my classes at the New School in NYU and Columbia, which is how to publish short pieces for top newspapers and magazines and literary journals. So that focuses on short pieces, could be 300 words to 1,500 words maybe. So short, there's five different kinds of work that I say I think is easy for someone that doesn't have any clips. But so it's personal essays, regional essays, op-ed pieces, and service pieces. I think those are the easiest. And then there's pitch letters where you can pitch an idea. So that's just starting out across between journalism and creative nonfiction. And that's how I started teaching. What happened was so many of my students were getting published, and a lot of those short pieces wound up leading to books. Because if you write a really good essay and you sell it to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or New York or New York Magazine, turns out a lot of editors and literary agents might approach you and say, hey, I really like this. Do you have any, you know, do you have a book in you? Is there a longer project here? So after I, for many, many years myself, just did short pieces, I personally started, I think it took me until I was 43 to break into books, but all of a sudden I was selling short pieces that were leading to books and my students were, and I was helping people get book deals, and I was doing a lot of one-shot seminars or two-week seminars, teaching people how to work with literary agents or which genre to do or how to work on a proposal, and so the Byline Bible did really well. So my editor said, you got a sequel. So I said, you know what, I think there's a sequel. So Byline Bible is how to start publishing short pieces. The Book Bible is when you want to take those short pieces and make them into a whole manuscript and sell a book. And some of it overlaps, but some of it is very specific to book writing.
Talk about Five Men Who Broke My Heart. That's the title of your book.
Yeah, that was my debut book.
Where did you get the idea? It's obviously a provocative title, and I'm sure a provocative read. So is there any, what's the word I'm looking for? Revenge, I suppose that's...
Well, I'll tell you what happened was I was working on a novel for a long time that everybody thought was really funny, and it was about how a friend of mine who I work with at New Yorker Magazine right out of college, she grew up in Greenwich Village with a writer father. And when I met her, I was like, oh my God, what was it like growing up in Greenwich Village and, you know, in the fiction world and with all these artists? And she looked at me and she said, what was it like growing up in Michigan with a doctor father having a normal family and a normal life? And I'm like, why the hell would anyone want to know that? Turns out she met my brother, the trauma surgeon from Michigan, married him, moved to Michigan, had four kids in 6 years, just like my mother, became the daughter my mother always wanted, and I realized we switched lives, and I married a writer. So I tried to write a book about it, and I tried to sell it for several years, and everyone liked it, but nobody was buying it. So I have a really tough critic. I always say to my students, if there's people in your life who will read your work and say, you're so smart, I love this, show it to someone else. So I had a really tough critic, Laura, who wrote for the Detroit News, and I said, Laura, read this and tell me why everybody likes it, but nobody's buying it. So she read it, and she said, okay, number one, you have no imagination whatsoever. Why are you writing fiction? And you know, all I had published was nonfiction, so she did have a point there. She said,
pretty blunt.
She said that, she was very blunt, and then she said, two sister-in-laws is the most boring subject in the world. Write about sex. People like sex. Sex sells. And number three, you're a little ambivalent about this person, and you write better about people that you love. So I went home swearing and thinking she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's crazy. And that I happened to be in Michigan that night. And I was visiting my family, and I read a book by Nick Hornby that was called High Fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And sorry about that. And High Fidelity... there was a scene where he goes back and he re-meets his top five heartbreaks of all time. And this is a novel. And so I thought to myself, oh, if a guy goes back to meet his top five heartbreaks of all time, he looks at her and he thinks, oh, she's still hot. I'll still sleep with her. And then it's all over. I thought, God, if a girl was going back to re-meet her top five heartbreaks of all time, there would be 1,000 pages of journal entries and notes from all the therapy sessions and the gum wrapper from the first date when she was 14. And I was thinking about that, and I happened to, an old boyfriend wanted to have a drink, so I was meeting him, and I started writing about it. And then when I came back to New York, another guy that I hadn't seen since college, he wanted his help, he wanted my help to publish a book. And he had been a science major, so I remember I wrote the line, he got a book deal, and I remember I wrote a line that was like, he was a biology major. Why did he get a book? I wasn't invading his space by curing cancer. And I just went on this weird roll, and I brought it into my writing group, and my writing group, which is really very tough and never likes anything at the beginning, said to me, wow, you should have gotten old and bitter a long time ago, because this rocks. So all of a sudden, I realized I didn't really have a good enough conceit. I had a lot of stupid relationships, but I didn't really have a good conceit for a memoir, you know, because memoirs can't just be, unless you're a president, nobody just wants to hear a chunk of your life or all your bad relationships. So all of a sudden, I came up with the idea of I was 40 at the time, what if a 40-year-old married journalist goes back to re-meet her top five heartbreaks of all time to find out what really went wrong? So as I was re-meeting the guys, instead of just talking to them, I would say, okay, what's your memory of me? Why do you think we broke up? And I interviewed them. And so that became my debut. And it was very exciting because I was on the Today Show and a lot of foreign rights, film TV rights. In fact, it was just re-optioned by Alyssa Milano again for a movie. So I hope they finally wind up making it. But so that was my debut. And it was provocative and sex did sell. And
scenes in there. You had genuine.
Well, I'll tell you what was interesting is that my writing group said, because they couldn't, you know, they needed to distinguish between the five guys. So my writing group said I should do a sex scene with each of the guys in past tense so we sort of understand the difference. So I did that. Interestingly, my husband, who does TV film, when it sold to TV film, he said, it's not going to make a TV film because you didn't sleep with anyone or even kiss anybody, so it's kind of non-dramatic, even though there was fantasies attached. So he said it's too non-dramatic. And there was a funny story where there was a big woman writer attached to write it, and I thought she was going to be perfect for it, and she didn't come up with a good script, and then the next thing she does is The Affair, about a guy who sleeps with a waitress and destroys his whole family's life. So I thought maybe it wasn't quite as dramatic as I wanted it to be. But anyway, that was the debut.
Is that the common thread as to why they broke up with you, because you didn't sleep with any of them? Because men are notorious for like, well, she doesn't like me because she won't sleep with
me. No. I meant that wasn't why. I meant that the reason why it didn't get made into a movie is because I was already married. So when I went back to re-meet my top five heartbreaks of all time, I didn't sleep with any of them.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. My husband thought it wasn't dramatic enough.
Was there a common thread, though, as to when you look back and you interviewed them, did each of these guys break up with you for a common reason, the same reason?
Well, what I came up with, which was actually quite helpful, was a long time before my shrink had said to me, I think when I was dating my husband, I once complained and said, he's not making me happy. And she said to me, love doesn't make you happy. Make yourself happy. Then you'll get love. And like it was like ding, 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 and I all of a sudden – that was illuminating. And when I re-met all the men, and we're talking about someone I met when I was 13 and someone I met when I was 15 and someone I met when I was 18, maybe what I realized or what they all had in common was that my expectations for relationships were unrealistic. So that I was putting too much of my heart and soul into a relationship instead of putting it into my own life and doing my own thing and letting them follow me. I was following them. What was really interesting was that, so I was married, and my husband and I, when I wrote the book, we were going through infertility, which is kind of part of what inspired it, Did I Marry the Right Person, because we were incompatible in this important way. And what was really interesting was he did not want me to write the book. He didn't want me to write about him. He didn't want me to write about our marriage, and he didn't want me to write about infertility. And so what was really interesting was I just felt like he was doing his career, and he was traveling all over the world to do all these TV film projects, and I just didn't listen to him. And I just said, hey, if you can't handle it, you know, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, I didn't grow up wanting to be bridal Barbie. I always wanted to be a writer. And so if you can't handle it, I understand. You could leave. And I wrote my book. And I became so excited and so thrilled and so happy because I had sort of learned how to, you know, make my own life thrilling that it kind of changed the dynamic of our marriage and it kind of fixed our marriage. So it was really interesting because then I went on to do all these books and that's what I've been doing. And so my own life is so exciting that I don't sit around waiting for him to come back. So weirdly, it was sort of like this bizarre self-fulfilling prophecy because I think we have like a great marriage and we just actually had our 26th anniversary. But so
congratulations. But what made him the right guy, and why, and what made you the right girl?
Well, you got to read the book. You got to read. you got to read Five Men Who Broke My Heart.
So, you are open about, a lot of people see a shrink. You're open about seeing a shrink. What's the core issue when you go see your shrink?
Well, interestingly, I had this great shrink who once said to me, he was, I think, at a certain point, he was $200 a session. And I said that you're ridiculously expensive. And my insurance, I had to pay and then do a deductible. So I wasn't, you know, they weren't covering that much. So I said, you're too expensive. And he said, well, I think good therapy will pay for itself. So I'm like, what the hell does that mean? And then it turned out over the course of a year therapy, he helped me quit cigarettes, alcohol, and drugs and figure out how to get book deals. And at the end of 1 year, I had 3 book deals, so I had quadrupled my income. So I'm like, oh, now I know what you mean. And I have 4 books written about therapy. So the one that I mentioned was an addiction therapy book, Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex. Then when he moved out of town, I wound up writing a book called Speed Shrinking, which turned out to be my first comic novel. And the joke of that book was that the inspiration for that book was, so he charged $200 a session, and I had this new insurance where therapists were $25 copay. So he was going out of town, and I didn't want to, he was moving, and I was afraid I would relapse, you know, with cigarettes and drugs and alcohol. So I desperately needed to find his replacement. So I decided, since they were only $25 a session, I was going to see 8 shrinks in 8 days. Instead of speed dating, I'd go speed shrinking to find his replacement. So that became my debut novel, Speed Shrinking. Then I wound up writing a book. We had a huge falling out after 15 years, and he was my mentor, and he refused to apologize. And so I most recently wrote a memoir called The Forgiveness Tour, How to Find the Perfect Apology, where the central question is, if you feel that someone in your life has slighted you or hurt you and they cannot say I'm sorry, should you forgive them? So that was the story of Forgiveness Tour, which was very, you know, very psychoanalytic, about this father figure who couldn't apologize. And then I wound up, after I was done with the therapy, he did apologize and we reconnected, and he had always wanted to write about his 30 years of addiction therapy to help the most amount of people. So we wound up collaborating on a self-help book called Unhooked, How to Quit Anything, which wound up being a New York Times bestseller. So therapy, not only did therapy help me figure out ways to make a living, which is so difficult, and how to compromise and how to be rational and how to figure out finances and relationships and stuff, but it literally gave me amazing subjects to write about. So I highly recommend it. I mean, you have to have the right therapist, of course. But, so I've actually written a lot about that.
So when your marriage was in an acrimonious phase, what was the issue?
Again, read Five Men Who Broke My Heart. I mean, you know, we were going through infertility, and I'm a raging feminist, and we both had big careers, so there was a lot going on. But what was pretty cool about it was, I always say to my students that writing is a way to take your worst experiences and turn them into the most beautiful art. So that was, you know, between therapy and writing about it, it was actually, you know, I was really glad that I dealt with it, that I faced it. You know, and there's a good line that says the only way out is through, you know. So there was a lot of issues that I dealt with and wrote about.
Your husband was one of the 5 men who broke your heart?
No.
No, but no. You do write about him in there.
Yes, I do write about him. Those were the men that before I met him. Before I met him, there were 5 men who broke my heart. And again, we were going through infertility, so it made me question, did I pick the right person or are we somehow incompatible? So I went back through my past to figure out whether I was supposed to have wound up with somebody else.
Do you have children now?
No.
Are you good with that? Are you good with, I mean, do you appreciate the freedom that you have by not having children, or is this still a source of regret?
No, yeah, I have a pretty exciting life. And I've written about that, too. You're going to have to Google me.
There's nothing that anybody can't know about you as long as they read your anthology.
Well, what did Nora Ephron say? Everything is copy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I have about, including co-authored books, I think I have about 7 memoirs out, but for my own writing, I have a series. So I have 5 Men Who Broke My Heart, which was about the screwed up relationships in the past in my marriage, Lighting Up, which was about the addiction therapy, The Forgiveness Tour, which was about, different ways of forgiving and, a sort of central therapeutic relationship in my life. And then I wrote a book called Only As Good As Your Word, Writing Lessons from My Favorite Literary Gurus, which is kind of a memoir of how I learned to be a writer and how I had these great mentors who kind of shaped me. So those are the ones that I've done on my own. And then I've co-authored several.
What do you tell your students? Now, you've already certainly revealed a lot. I can already see that certain messages that you give to your students, but expand on that. When somebody's in your class or you're doing private sessions with them, what are some of the headlines there that you try to really impart to them?
Well, I have pretty clearly in Byline Bible and Book Bible that every single person's different and everybody's goal is different. So, figuring out what you want exactly is a good start. So somebody who's taking my newspaper magazine class, I say, what do you want? They say, I want to get published. I say, okay, come back and show me the publication that you want to write for. So they'll bring me the New York Times, and I'll say, okay, there's 27 places where a freelancer could break in. Which section do you want to break in? So we spend a lot of time really figuring out what's the goal. What's your goal? Do you just want to get an A in the class? Do you want to get published? Do you want to get the most amount of money? Do you want, and students have made, between $1,000 and $5,000 for one piece sometimes. Other times you give away a piece for free or you get $100, but it's your first clip. So is your goal that you want to get published? Is your goal that you want to make the most amount of money? Is the goal that you have a book? Do you want to save people and help the world, which a lot of people do, that their goal is to reach the most amount of people? Sometimes it's a cathartic release where they're trying to work through issues with relationships or with losing somebody or mental illness or physical illness, so it depends. I teach a lot of different kinds of classes, so it depends on, all writing and publishing classes, but so it pretty much depends on what the person wants. And some of my undergrads and graduates, they're just coming to get credit, so their goal might not even have involved publishing. Or they were seeking me out because I was the only teacher that was going to help them get published and bring in different editors and agents to talk about how to shape the material, to find an audience and to be able to make a living. So, absolutely depends a lot on, where somebody is and what they want. And then once they tell me what they want, then we go over the options. And people in my online classes, in my online pitch classes, I bring in 15 different top editors. And again, people tell me what their goal is. And if they tell me, my goal is I want to write for the Washington Post, then they'll throw out 10 ideas and I'll tell them which will be the most likely to sell. And I give all kinds of techniques. For example, when you're writing short pieces, especially for newspapers, which are playing off of the news, making something timely is going to wind up being, that's going to wind up getting you a clip the fastest. So we talk about how do you find something timely if you have a topic, So
what about query letters to agents, literary agents, let's say? So let's stick with the fiction genre here. What are the mistakes, common mistakes, and what works?
Well, I have some sample letters to agents. I would say the biggest mistakes I see when it comes to people trying to sell novels is, number one, I have never met someone who sat in their house or apartment at their computer, finished a novel, and it was ready to go to a literary agent, first of all. So a big mistake people make, and they'll literally say to me, oh, I finished my novel last week. Give me the names of all your agents. So if you finish a book, the first thing you want to do is you want to have readers. So you want to have beta readers, which could be classmates or colleagues or friends, but you really want people who've published in your genre. You need teachers, you need mentors, you need a classroom setting. Some people need an MFA program for 2 or 3 years. Some people do a PhD. And or you could pay a ghost editor to read through the whole thing. Or you could take a class with somebody like me, and I know a lot of novelists, and memoirists take classes, but basically, first thing you do after you write a book and try to, you know, you try to do it the best you can, you write a, you know, you read what you want to be writing, you write a whole manuscript, is you get feedback. Usually from that feedback, you rewrite the whole thing many times. So you really don't want to be even considering agents until you either have a completed manuscript or, with nonfiction, a completed proposal that really has been critiqued and you've gotten feedback and you've revised it and it's really, you know, it's really the best that it can be. And it's unusual that people know how to do that. Usually people are sending out crap and then they're not getting any response, or they're getting rejected and they don't know why. And they complain, see, it doesn't work, and then they show me the first page, and I'm like, well, this doesn't make any sense, and it's in the wrong tense, and this is how you start a book, and you're not even clear on what's fiction and what's nonfiction, so take a class, you know, slow down. But anyway, so once you really have a polished, great, you know, fiction manuscript or a proposal, then I think the biggest mistake people make is they write these long, boring letters. Like, nobody wants to read, you know, a 700-word letter. I mean, I've gotten agents, and I help my students get agents based on, like, 100 words. You know, so succinct. They're busy, you know. It's an unsolicited letter. So, you know, what you do, and again, there's specific examples in Book Bible, is you look up the literary agent. You know, maybe you go to your favorite books and you see that this is the agent that handled my favorite book and my book is similar, and you start out by complimenting the agent. Or, by the way, I do quite a lot of book events. And like I said, editors zoom in my classes. If you go to my website, you could watch free panels. So you really want to have a connection. You don't just want to look in the yellow pages, age literary agent. You want to find an agent that handles the right books. There's something called manuscript wish list. You know, go find an agent that does similar books than yours, who you think might be the right person. You write them a letter saying, I love the book that you published by so-and-so, or you were great at Sue Shapiro's panel, or I love the interview that you did in Publishers Weekly, or, you know, you explain to them why them, and then you very succinctly say, I am looking for representation for my debut novel, which is called Speed Shrinking, and it's about how when my shrink left town and, you know, I saw 8 shrinks in 8 days instead of speed dating, it was speed shrinking. You know, you give the Hollywood movie pitch, and then you just say one or two lines about yourself that are relevant. So in that book, I would say, you know, my work has appeared in, and I would just say my biggest publications, and I'd say, and I'm a shrinkaholic. People make the mistake if they just give their whole damn resume. So, you know, went to undergrad here and went to graduate school here and studied philosophy, and then I switched to math, and then I switched to English, and then I got another degree, and then I worked at a bank, but I didn't like that. And then it's like, cut all that crap. Cut all of it. You know, just say one interesting thing about yourself or one place that you've been published. You know, and keep it really, really short. And also, people don't follow instructions. So they're just like, you know, they're emailing a 375-page manuscript, and if they would have Googled the writer's guidelines from the agent, it would say, I only want the first page.
Yeah.
I'm not open for submission until September, and they send it in August.
Right.
You know, so there's just so many mistakes that people make, which is part of the reason why with Book Bible and with Byline Bible, I really tried to, you know, I interviewed a lot of editors and agents. I tried to make it as succinct as possible because, you know, I am teaching a lot of people in a lot of different fields, a lot of information quickly, but it's based on, you know, decades of doing this and trial and error. So I do think that there's a lot that one can learn about, you know, how to get published quickly. And again, it's the books that I wish I would have found when I was starting out, because really there's very, very few books that explain this kind of stuff to you in a way that's colloquial and that's, you know, that really gives inside information.
Well, being that you're in a writing marriage, is your husband your first read and you his?
Sometimes, but, you know, one of the things I found is that having my own life and my own writing group and my old editors and my own agents is kind of better sometimes, you know, because I don't want to burden him. And he's a professor in TV film at NYU, so I don't, you know, we both have a lot of students that are showing us work. So there's a time when it's good to show each other work, but we don't want to stress each other out. And also, you know, I don't really want to be criticizing him, and he doesn't really want to be criticizing me. So sometimes, you know, the first read isn't necessarily the right one.
You don't want to end up back in therapy.
Right.
Not couple therapy, anyway.
Right.
What writers do you read?
You know, I read everything, but you know what's interesting is when people ask me, I usually mention my students' books because I can't stand it when somebody asks, you know, who are you reading, and then they name off seven cliche, big, famous, you know, people that everybody already knows anyway who don't need to be plugged. So if somebody asks me, I literally have a stack of about 20 books by students that have come out that I'm trying to finish. And I would say right now, because I'm working on a book myself, I'm more apt to read. I read five or six newspapers a day. So I'm more apt to read newspapers right now and books in the exact genre that I'm writing. So, yeah. But I would say that check out Book Bible or Byline Bible. And I have all my stuff on social media, so people can follow me on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter. And my email is pretty easy to find out there. And if anybody, you know, emails me and say, oh, I love your book, but I have these five questions, if they email me at night, I answer them back because I, now that I quit all my other addictions, I'm addicted to email. But also, I have to cold call so many people, editors and agents in my own career, that I feel for karma's sake that I have to answer everybody else's email. So if anybody has any questions, they're allowed to email me.
And again, Susan's email address appears in the episode notes along with the URL to her website so you can learn more about her. Her social media handles are in there as well. Your writing routine, when you're writing, I understand some of the research. Right now, five newspapers a day is part of your research, but when you actually have to do the writing, what's your routine?
All right, I only have a minute, but so what I do is I wake up and write. I had a mentor who, and I once complained that I had writer's block. He said, plumbers don't get plumber's block. Just wake up and get to work. A page a day is a book a year, so that stayed with me. And I would say that I wake up and write. It has to be 250 words a day. I usually decide in advance whether I'm going to, you know, whether I'm working on a new book or whether I'm working on a short piece.
250 words is your baseline.
Yeah, 200. I have to write 250 words every day, so I do that. And then it just depends on, you know, what do I have due? You know, is there something, you know, is there something specific if I've pitched a piece to a newspaper or magazine or if I'm writing a piece to plug one of the books? So then I finish that. And then I have two great writing groups, very, very critical writing groups on Thursday and Sunday, so I tend to only send work out on Monday and Friday after the group has killed it, taken a look at it. And I usually kick it into shape, and I even pay ghost editors before I go to my own agent because I want the material to really be to sing and to really be ready to send out. So I work a lot. I'll revise a lot before I decide it's ready to give an agent.
Well, Susan, you are all energy and honesty. Thank you very much for coming on the program.
Yeah, my pleasure. And like I said, anybody that emails me, I promise I'll email back. So it's profsue123@gmail.com. And I especially love it if people read Book Bible or read Byline Bible and then they email me more questions. I love that, and I'm more than happy to answer and help anybody that I can.